KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find Here Be Monsters now at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and kcrw.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Again, one of my favorite things about doing this show, especially in the last few years, I've gotten to have a few people here from GQ, Gentleman's Quarterly, the magazine is, and the style guy again, going into his second year as style guy officially, although I think unofficially Mark Anthony Green has been a style guy for his entire life. He's sitting across from me. First of all, thanks so much for doing this.
Oh, man, thank you so much. Huge fan.
Oh, you're huge the one. Fan. See, I was going to meet you, and now we're off.
Yeah.
Tell me, though, it's your second year now. I'm imagining that you felt in your first year you had goals you set for yourself in terms of what the your position as style guy was going to be, GQ. What were you thinking that was going to be?
Well, I wanted to make style guy. I still want to make style guy extremely accessible.
That's one of the things you do, even with the Reddit. You're basically taking stuff from people who are saying, well, you know, my girlfriend dressed this way, but I dressed this way. How do we bring this together? And you go, wow, that's a great – you actually seem to be living in it rather than just commenting on it.
Oh, man, I'm living that. Yeah. But it doesn't mean that there's not a certain level of expertise. But I'm more so like the friend that can make a phone call and speak to the guy that's been doing it for 40, 50 years. I'm trying to figure it out at the same time you're trying to figure it out. And, you know, the goal in this first year was to just make it seem like you could get a hold of the style guy. You could get a hold of the expertise. And some things have really, really worked, like, you know, the Reddit AMA.
Which I like because it really is. Did you just decide you want to keep your ear to the ground in the way that it hadn't been before?
Yeah. And if you look at it, I mean, okay, so let's say there's one style guy column every issue. Let's say he answers four questions per issue, right? So, you know, that's 4 times 12 times however many years style guy existed. I probably answered in just that Reddit AMA, you know, 200, 300 questions. It's got nothing to do with Twitter, nothing to do with the Facebook Live and all these other different social media platforms. So the goal is to, you know, really, really, really make guys feel like they can reach out and ask those questions. Whether I publish them or not, a lot of times guys will email me and I'll email them back and, you know.
Oh, you do? You do actually email people back?
I email them back and it'll be just an exchange between me and that guy or, you know, a lot of guys. It's if it's super personal, you know, it's like I'm getting married and my wife and I are arguing over what should we do? Can you just settle this? I get a few of those, right? And so that always feels super important and I love that because I can just kind of focus on making sure that they have one less thing to deal with as they, you know, make this huge commitment, which is cool.
Because a lot of those questions, too, on the Reddit AMA are really these kind of – almost these crisis point questions. A lot of guys, it's like this sort of make or break kind of question that you get a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that, man, it's funny because the perception – the very incorrect perception is that men clothes and style don't give men anxiety. And that's just not true. Even the most stylish man, there's certain things that he's just trying to figure out. And it's cool at 28 to be able to have conversations with guys that, you know, that my father's age or, you know, older than that they're just kind of looking for an answer and we talk it out together and to see, you know, the things that I'm going to be trying to figure out when I'm 40, when I'm 50, when I'm 60, you know, that's a kind of a trip and it's cool. But, man, I would say in the first year people have been really, really responsive, and it's been fun. You know,
because I was wondering if it was a little bit off-putting for you, though, because again, just following the Reddit as I do, it's kind of really interesting how much people want help.
Yeah, you know what? It's definitely as a human being, Mark Anthony, as a person, I am still getting used to that aspect of it. People will stop me at a store or something. And they'll be like, oh, they'll just ask. They won't introduce themselves, you know. And that's what you want. Like, you build it so that, you want to be accessible. And so I'm kind of learning what that means. The other day I was at Dover Street Market and this kid walked up to me and he was like, these are these. And I was with some friends and I just answered it. And I didn't say anything else to him. He didn't exchange any other pleasantries with me. And they were like, do you know him? And I was like, oh, you know, I don't. I never met this kid in my life, which was cool, which is cool. It also is like, you know.
A little daunting, though, isn't it? I mean, because it's a lot of responsibility placed on you, isn't it?
It's an honor, though, man. I don't want to complain too much about it. And
I'm not, trust me, clearly, you're a humble guy and you're excited by this. But it's again, it's been a year.
Yeah.
And just 2-3 years ago, did you think this is going to happen? Would you, if I
no.
told you 3 years ago, so guys going to walk up to you and say, okay, do I get the tissues or do I go with the right. Prada sneakers?
Right,
what do I
right,
do here?
Right. Yeah, no. If I'm being completely honest with you, no. And I'm very, very, I obsess over the future. And I try to think, what am I going to be as cool as Elvis Mitchell in 15 years? Like, I know the answer to that is no.
Because you started off past that point.
But I have something to aspire to. So I think about it, but no, I didn't, I never really thought about this like that. We have a million ideas, and I say we because it really is a team effort to make Style Guy what it is. You know, people have to build the column, you field the questions. You know, every time we tape, we did a Facebook Live. We're going to do those weekly now because it's been really responsive. But we're filming it on a phone, but it's still, there's four people that are involved in making sure that it looks as good as possible filmed on a phone. And all those things, I mean, it really, really is a large group effort. And I think in the first year, the successes that you've seen, a lot of those, it's because there's a lot of people that were never thinking about how to make Style Guy special. And then they turn their efforts and their creativities in making it special. I'm the guy that shows up and I get the credit, but it really, really is not like that. And it's an amazing team of people that trying to make sure that I don't mess it up, man, you know, making sure that I don't brick it, as the kids say. So
it's the treatment. I don't know what's in my guest Mark Anthony Green's water bottle. He can't have any more of it. He's going to talk about me like that. He's the Style Guy at GQ. He's going into a second year now. And I guess one of the things I wanted to say, too, about what the column is now is it really feels like you want to feel like it's different kinds of questions being asked in each column. Because it feels almost like there's a build in it. You start here, you build towards something, there's a conclusion. That feels different.
Yeah.
Because obviously you felt that you wanted to make it belong to you. And three issues in, I felt like that was happening already.
Yeah, thank you. And it's I can only do it the way that I can do it. If I wanted to do it like someone else, if I wanted to do it like Glenn, I couldn't.
You mean Glenn O'Brien, who invented it.
Yeah, so Glenn O'Brien started Style Guy. He was a Style Guy for many, many years. He's a legend. And if I wanted to, I couldn't do it like him. If I wanted to, I couldn't do it like Nick Wooster. I couldn't do any other fashion person that you know. I can only do it the way that I would do it. And, I love to tell stories for a living. I think that just kind of the natural progression of it. Part of the reason I wanted to be a writer is, my dad's a funny guy. If he were in here right now, he'd just kind of be making fun of everybody. He just can tell a good story, you know? And like that type of like barbershop talk, like the funniest guy in the barbershop. And I always wanted to be like that with him. And I inherited a little bit of it from him. You know, even if I'm answering a question, if you ask me, can I wear a uniform, a self-imposed uniform, or what about these Chelsea boots, or can I wear suede in my whatever, I still want to give you something that is a little cinematic. And I just think that's like a personal thing to me. I wanted to tell a story, to have an arc, to make you laugh a little bit, you know?
And build a little tension and build towards a climax. I mean, it's almost like a four-act piece, each of the columns.
Thank you. That's nice of you to say.
But that's kind of something that, again, I noticed pretty early on that you wanted to feel like it was building towards something. And just hearing you talk about story and storytelling, that's a key component of all of this.
Yeah. I mean, how many times can I tell a guy what to wear for a wedding, you know? I mean, you know, just logistically, I've done it for 2 seconds, you know, 1 year in the grand scheme of things of doing this, as long as I want to do it, if Jim Nelson and GQ and the readers will have me, you know, it's 1 second. And I want to make sure that it never feels, you know, in a lot of ways, I'm my toughest critic. And if I feel like I've said it before, I've heard it before, I will run away from it. And so a lot of times that tension or that technique that you pick up on is a way of just making sure that it's interesting to me. And you know, again, I'm sure some questions are better than others, some answers are better than others, but I'm thinking about how am I going to answer that exact same question or question very similar to that in 20 years and making sure that I leave some type of room open so that I don't repeat myself.
Well, who were the writers you read growing up? Because there's obviously a sort of sense of, again, going back to this, of creating narrative in the way you think.
Man, what an amazing question. I will say the first writer, well, there's a couple big moments. The first book that ever made me cry was Of Mice and Men. And I remember being my entire basketball team. We had like, I used to play basketball very seriously. And we...
What'd you play?
I was a point guard. I mean, my dad is 6'5", my brother's 6'5". So to them,
so you're,
I was a
little man.
Yeah, okay. So I had to do that. Now I'm like 6'1", 6'2" now.
So you were the enforcer of the family.
No. I was a middle child. I barely got anything. I enforced nothing. But I remember, so, you know, I'm there with my team, and we're all, you know, we're athletes, and we're young men. I was a freshman in high school. And
which grew up?
Kansas City, Missouri. Yeah, Kansas City, Missouri, man. And I remember reading that, and I don't want to ruin the novella for anybody at home if you haven't done your homework already, but
it's public radio. It's okay.
I'm assuming if you're listening to NPR, you've read it a million times over. But somebody dies at the end, basically, and I just remember crying. And my friends made fun of me. I didn't really care. You know, I was never like too worried about being picked on. I always dressed differently.
Were you always that guy?
I was always that guy. I can't explain why. Sometimes it made me cooler than others. A lot of times it didn't.
Was it your way of being the rebel in your family? Or was your whole family like that?
My whole family is into style, but I was always weird with mine. Like I would wear like pink blazers. You know,
Kansas City,
as a young black kid, not around a lot of black kids at school, lived around a bunch of black kids in my neighborhood. And so it was very weird, you know, with all the white kids in Kansas City, in the suburbs. It was extremely weird in my neighborhood, Northeast Kansas City, Missouri, which is, you know, a troubled place.
What a politic way of putting it.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, there's love both places, man. And I don't know. I always felt like, I know that really helped my style because I had to dress. I did speech and debate later when I was in high school, and I was involved with all these different things. And, you know, my day could be really diverse, and I had to have an outfit that I believed in, because if I was dressing for the kids at school, the kids in my neighborhood, they'd make fun of me. If I was dressing, I mean, people are going to make fun of you regardless. So
if you're wearing a pink blazer, do you want to draw attention to yourself anyway?
Yeah, and I just wasn't afraid, you know? I mean, I was like 15 in a pink blazer, you know, and I was going to a tailor when I was like 13. And yeah, I mean, you know, my mother and father, they always had us working. And the moment I had my own money, you know, I was buying rare sneakers. And
first thing you bought? What was the first thing you bought with your own money? First fashion piece you bought?
Oh, man. It was a pair. First, like, expensive The first expensive fashion thing I ever bought, I bought a pair of De La Soul Nike SB Dunks.
You still have them, don't you?
I still have them. I haven't worn them.
You've never worn them?
I've worn them. I wore them like three times, and I remember each one was to this school dance. It was really
big. You went to a dance? You went something crazy.
Yeah, but like, come on, like it was like when you're like 15, 16, a school dance, you think that that's like there's nothing bigger than that. It's like
that's
a wedding.
And
you
know what I mean? Apparently none of people were going to step on your shoes, so why not wear them to a school dance? Anyway.
It was a tame one. Okay. And my date, she was everything. I'm not going to say her name or her Michelle Gay, but she was everything at the time.
She's thank goodness you only used initials.
Yeah. She was the most beautiful thing in Kansas City, man. She was everything. Yeah, I had this little outfit for him. And
so
all that.
You got the sneaks. What else are you wearing with them? What were you wearing?
So I had a pair of jeans. This was when Pharrell Williams and Kanye West had just kind of like started to take over the world.
So you got your best BBC look going on, don't you?
Yeah, so I had, but that was when they dressed up though. So it wasn't like a skateboarder thing, even though Nike SBs are technically a skateboard shoe.
Yes, that's what they're wearing the SB.
Yeah, exactly. So I had a pair of jeans. I remember the outfit like it was yesterday. I had a pair of jeans. I had this sweater vest that was my dad's, and I took it without asking him. I got in trouble for it that day, but whatever. We dealt with it. We dealt with it, and we've moved on. And I had on this button down that was entirely too big, but it was good. I had a bow tie.
What color was the button down?
The bow tie, the button down was white, right, because okay. I had a lot of colors going on. So, and the shoes, they're like reflective, so you can't really do too much else. I mean, it was really tacky. It was a tacky outfit that I am extremely proud of still to this day.
And the blazer, with what blazer? Because you're wearing a blazer with
it. I had a blazer over it. The blazer was like a textured. You couldn't really call it a houndstooth because it wasn't that. It was like a little mini check.
Like tank head almost.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And it wasn't a bad blazer. It was from Brooks Brothers. I bought it from a thrift shop. But that's the thing, you know, I love, part of the reason why I love being style guys, I'll get a kid from like Wyoming, and you could tell he's like 16 by the nature of the question, right? And he's like, can you help me with this thing? And I remember not having anything like that. And I'm like, oh, that's cool that this kid in the Midwest, you know, if you're in like a big city, there's so many style influence. If you live in New York, you could live in the Bronx, but you could go to Soho and see a bunch of stylish people. I was in Kansas City, Missouri. I couldn't go anywhere and see a bunch of stylish people. You might see one or two if you were lucky to find one. And again, Kansas City is my heart. I love Kansas City. But that's why I can be honest about it. So that kid in Wyoming, to like, you know, tweet him back or to answer his question on Facebook Live or to email him back, whatever, I'm not saying that I'm changing the world, but I know that I would have really appreciated that at 14, 15.
I'm going to take a break. My guest who's changing the world one outfit at a time is Mark Anthony Green. He's the style guy at GQ in the second year now. It's the treatment. There's more to come, Steve.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for handpicked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download it for free at kcrw.com/apps.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm here with Mark Anthony Green, who's a style guy at Gentleman's Quarterly.
That's a great name for a podcast, by the way.
What's that, Mark Anthony Green? You're right, that is a great name for a podcast.
No, The Treatment's good, man.
We've been here for 20 years now. But we were talking, we hit on any number of things, but you were talking about writers. Specifically, I was asking about writers because, again, yes. For me, the quality of the writing and the storytelling is so, even the way you answer the questions.
Right.
And also that you're talking before the break about hearing from the 16-year-old kid in the middle of nowhere and having been that kid once yourself. That is a big part, too, if you're making this approachable. So it's not just somebody reaching out from on high and picking four questions out of a barrel and not knowing how it's chosen. You want this thing to be something that lives for people.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I got to say this about the writing. I mean, okay, I'm 28. I've been at GQ for 5 years. Before that, I interned at GQ, and it was the only place I applied to work. It's the only magazine I wanted to write for. And I grew up as a writer and a lot as like a human at GQ, you know? So there's certain editors there that they didn't just edit a story. They were teaching me how I was going to write for the rest of my life. And, they're still there, right? So when I first got there, I was a child. I didn't know anything about anything. I had read a lot of different, my literary influences were very different. I had never heard of David Foster Wallace, right? I had probably read everything James Baldwin has ever written and everything ever written about him. I went to Morehouse College. So I didn't take a single—
The best film criticism of all time, The Devil Finds Work.
Lance, say that again. It's amazing. And so I'm saying is that I came in and I didn't know anything about magazine writing at all. I took two journalism classes at Morehouse.
Even though James Baldwin was a big part of Esquire, which started GQ.
Well, yeah, apparel arts. Yeah, that whole thing. That's
another conversation.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah. But still, there's a connection there.
Yes, that for sure. I mean, I read GQ. I read, a lot of the major profiles and Frank Sinatra as a cold and all that stuff. But I didn't know anything about anything. And so Jim Nelson, Devin Freeman, Will Welsh, John Wilde, all these guys, they like taught me how I was going to do it. And, a good editor doesn't change your voice. A good editor shows you how to be at your best.
And helps you find your voice.
Yeah. And so I'm working with like my original sensei still. And I think that's why when I'm good, it's because the editing is strong. And, those guys, they don't hold any punches, They'll tell me exactly when I'm phoning it in and when I can get better. So,
but you mentioned Baldwin, and there's a sense of sort of drama and discovery, sense that, again, for me, The Devil Finds Work, that's something I read as a kid. It's one of the reasons I'm doing what I do now is because of that.
Yeah.
And it's still shocking to me how few people knew that James Baldwin wrote about film.
James Baldwin, I'll say this about James Baldwin. James Baldwin was a gay black atheist in the 1920s. There is no one more alone than James Baldwin. I mean, if you really think about that. If you're a writer at home, there's something about us, and you're in this too, like, you're Elvis, you're a very charismatic guy. I've been at parties where you're a nice guy. You're there's charisma and you're suave. But writers, there's a thing about us where we could sit in a room by ourselves. We're kind of loners to a certain degree. And I think that Baldwin was the ultimate loner. And when I would have my loner moments growing up, I know my mother, it would make her feel kind of weird because I could go from the bell of the ball to, not wanting to leave my apartment. And if you're a loner, you might want to consider being a writer. I think those two things go hand in hand.
So you think your natural temperament pointed you towards that?
Yeah, I do. I mean, and again, like, I love people. And, no one at GQ's office would probably say that I was a loner, but all my friends would, because I very rarely go out. And
is that true?
Yeah, I like to be home. I mean,
because if you look at just following you online, your social life seems to be pretty active.
Man, I'm blessed, man. I have a lot of cool friends, and I get to do a lot of cool stuff because I live in New York. But I will say that there are people that go out 4 or 5 nights a week. I'm not one of those people. I go out if there's something that I really want to see. I love music. I love shows. But just to go out, I mean, I don't drink. I've never drank. I've never smoked. So, like, partying and all that, it's never really been my thing. I date, but that's a lot, that's like a one-on-one dinner hang type of situation.
That's so interesting because I'm just thinking about Go Tell on the Mountain as you were talking about that. And that sort of sense of drama, but also that singularity, sort of recognizing that you are the center of your own world, which is so much a part of that, is what you're really talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a weird, there's a little narcissism to it, for sure, and just being in your own head. Elvis, I think you need to make the James Baldwin biopic, man. Like, who better than you?
Okay, Kevin Hart is James Baldwin. This is a treat. We're talking about many things with my guest, Mark Anthony Green, who's the style guy at GQ. It's his second year.
Oh, my God.
Before we go on with that, here's this thing I've actually kind of noticed about GQ. that happens if you were like a reader of the magazine. I started reading it when I was in high school, and I was just basically a lot like you, a kid in Detroit who you could dress a certain kind of way, yeah. but if you were interested in basically a mashup, which is what at some points happens yeah. to you when you read GQ.
You have different influences.
Yeah, but there are three things – I like to call the three stages of GQ. One day I'm going to have something that's in GQ. I'm going to wear something that's in the magazine. Two, you're seeing something in a magazine, you're buying it. And then you pick up the magazine, you already have it.
Right. So, well, you have it. The rest of us are still trying to get it.
I'm sorry. It's just dusty in here. I'm not really tearing up at all. But you have probably gone through that now, haven't you? You probably like lived that
way.
You
had
that
point. No. I still look at that
magazine. I'm sorry. What kind of boots are you wearing again right now?
I have on what are these? No.
Oh, you don't know. He got so many shoes. He can't even call it.
True.
You forgot what he wears.
Listen, I will say this, man. Jim Moore, I still, and I'm not just saying this, so we have like wall meetings, right? Which is where we lay out the magazine on the wall.
Right? Sure.
And you basically can see all the magazine at once. It's my favorite meeting. It's my favorite thing. It's like art, you know, and everything's kind of hitting you at once instead of you flipping through pages. And there hasn't been a single wall meeting where I haven't seen something in it, and it kind of rocked my world. And it that works for stories as well, that the photography. Fred Woodward, our art director, he's a genius. He's a legend. If it's a pair of shoes, whatever. There are many things, and I am still absolutely a fan. I get to contribute to that, but I learn still from. I mean, Jim Moore's been at GQ for 35 plus years.
Well, I've had both those guys doing the show, and that thing that's happened when it came up with both those guys, and I hadn't even thought about it until I was talking with, about a year ago when Jim Moore came in. Because we both really grew up with the magazine, but we're about the same age. And it's like, you get that point, you go, oh, man, I'm just going to do that one. I'm going to
It's almost
like this taste. You're going to have something that's in that magazine.
Yep.
But what you're talking about is the magazine is now much like you. And I think that's one of the reasons you're in this position now. So the magazine is much more responsive to the world than it used to be.
Yes.
It used to be this thing that laid out rules. And there's one thing you know if you have any kind of sense of style, that there are no rules.
Yeah.
The magazine can tell you this. But if you are who you are, I mean, I'm telling those guys, I've been wearing Vim for 10 years. It's only been the magazine for two.
Right.
And so at a certain point, you're just not looking. It becomes more like another voice.
Right. Now, you're a perfect example. Right? For the people at home, because this is obviously a podcast, my man Elvis has on an orange mesh.
Purple. That's right. You want to say purple.
Well, I was going to do the piping first, but I think it's navy. What is it?
It is navy pipe.
Okay. So navy pipe, orange fishnet polo shirt, open, right? He's got on vintage Margiela Chelsea boots. Wait, let me see what's on the legs. And white jeans. He's got a belt on that he bought. Tell him about the belt.
Anyway, now,
so this is my point. This is my point. There was a point in time where being a well-dressed man meant that you were in a suit and that, you know, blue went with brown. You don't wear black unless it's unless you're going to a few. Like there were like 12 rules.
You don't wear white for Labor Day.
Yes, there were 12 rules or whatever,
and you don't wear white in the city even actually. White was something
right,
you wore
exactly
on the weekend.
And this is the Uber era. You could be a 65-year-old guy. You could be 80 and have a pair of Common Project sneakers on and look cool, look your age. But I think it's a mindset and. GQ isn't a magazine for men who don't embrace change. It's not. It just really, really isn't. We're about to have a woman president, and that is amazing. You know?
Fingers crossed. But anyway, that's another whole show. But again, I think for you, the GQ you came up in that you're now a part of is a GQ I do think it's – and I talk about with both Jims when they were here. Mm-hmm. It's really a magazine that's much more about reacting.
Yes.
I mean, they were both saying there's a time when GQ as an institution, because it is that, would not have embraced fast fashion, that would look down on its nose at that kind of thing. That there's just a GQ that was more about being an authority figure.
Right. Well, I will say fast fashion, I think we have come to them a little bit, but more so they've stepped their game up.
things have just gotten better. The quality's gotten better. The designs have gotten better. The campaigns have gotten better.
That's probably, to some extent, the influence of GQ on that.
I'm sure. And a lot of that is to Jim Moore's credit and Jim Nelson's credit. But at the end of the day, there are a lot of bad clothes that you don't see in GQ. That still exists.
That's why God made the internet. But, yeah. I do feel like, though, there's a part of GQ that doesn't say that you can't try anything anymore.
Oh, yeah. No. I mean, there are very few things, and I'll just speak to myself as style guy, that I will say, look, there's no way to do this the right way.
Okay, yeah. So what are the
square-toed shoes. There's no way to do square-toed shoes the right way.
So I shouldn't have worn my Aldos here today. That's what you're trying to tell me.
I will not say anything negative about Aldo. If that's your jam, I'm sure that there's great things there. Not going to set me up, Elvis, man. You're not going to set me up. Listen.
Don't take the bait. Just keep walking. Nothing to see here.
They're very. I mean, we have got the guys that we like the most. I mean, look at Jared Leto is on the cover of the new GQ Style, and if you haven't checked out GQ Style, you should absolutely do that. It's like a quarterly magazine, and you know, it's the hyper fashion version of GQ. And Jared Leto, this is guys like, you know, he's on top of the world. He's an eccentric. He's a weird guy. He has incredible style. Some days he's wearing a cape, and some days, you know, he's in a Tom Ford tuxedo, and he looks like, you know, the most rakish man on the planet. Obviously, some outfits are better than others, but at the end of the day, like, you couldn't see him wear something. I think Jared would even say some outfits are better than others. Like, some days he nails it, some days he doesn't. But he is 1,000% unapologetic, and that is what we like. We want you, and we want to help you build a sartorial confidence that will help you find a mate, help you in the boardroom, help you whatever it is that you need, and that type of extra pep and swagger. We're here to help you find that. And you can't, to go back to the last point, you can't do that if you are focused on rules made in the 60s. You can't do that if you're afraid of looking different. You can't do that if you are self-conscious about old stigmas and things like that, and not wanting to wear a bright orange polo shirt, you know. And to everyone's credit at the magazine, and, you know, I came in at 23, so obviously, or 22, obviously, you know, I was too young to... You know, I was young and bold and dumb and stupid. So I didn't have any of those reservations. But, you know, the people that have been there for 20 years, 30 years, they didn't have those reservations either. And so it's not a magazine for scared men. It's just not. We're not the Scaredy Cat magazine. I don't know if I could work for a magazine that focused on keeping everyone looking the same, keeping things the same.
Because it must have been for you, as somebody who presumably grew up reading the magazine too, that
absolutely
there are things that for you, you use as a taking off point, but you still were not going to just be, strictly speaking, treating it as a Bible. You're going to do your own thing fold GQ into that.
It's like, okay, white jeans are cool and here's a bunch of ways to wear them, but I might wear mine a little different. And that's the thing, is I want to learn about it. We try to do a good job, and I definitely think we hit the mark a lot on this, which is just giving you the knowledge so that you can go to the store and do it your way. You know, like mesh polo shirts were a trend in the last GQ Style, the first issue of GQ Style, so the one before the Jared Leto issue. And, you know, there's a lot of ways to wear a mesh polo shirt and look cool, Exhibit A, Elvis. And then there's a lot of ways to do it and not look cool. And there's a lot of men that would never wear a mesh polo shirt. You know, it's not saying that you have to do something, and it's not saying do it exactly like this, but here's some ways to do it. And these are things that you want to make sure that you're thinking about. And, you know, this isn't a conservative office thing, and, you know, all the different examples. And then we're going to show you the coolest ones. Our market research and our field work, as I always call it, I think we're second to none. I really do. I mean, if we're going to shoot a polo shirt, we're going to call in 100, 150 polo shirts. So we see everything, and we really try to pick the best. And by best, we don't mean most expensive.
You mean like the one you're wearing?
My polo shirt is good, but, you know, it's from Fred Perry. This is like, you know, this is a...
But
it's an everyman polo shirt.
But it's two different textures. Come on.
It's cool. It's cool. It's not what you have on, but it's cool. You know, it's like, you know, I like to do a high-low thing. Most of my jeans are from Acne. I believe in Acne wholeheartedly. And that's like $150, $200. That's somewhat reasonable. The boots are a little more. The boots are from Saint Laurent. But the polo shirt, you know.
Are they?
You can find this polo shirt for $60. Shut up, Elvis. I remember my polo shirts when I was in high school, the uniform, they were $40. So somebody come get Elvis, man. Come get him.
I'm going to go get myself because we're out of time. You're welcome back here anytime you want.
Oh, man. Thank you so much for having me. Such an honor.
Please. My guest rocking those shoes, God knows where they're from or what they cost, is Mark Anthony Green. He's the style guy at Gentleman's Quarterly, a recording engineer who graciously gave us some extra time here at NPR Today in New York. His Jeannie Montalvo-Lucar. The show is mixed by Kat Yor, is edited by Blake Byte, who's associate producer. I'm going to go kick off my Aldo Chelsea boots. It's the treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to KCRW.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.